Chapter 27. Anna was upstairs, standing in front of the mirror, and with Anushka's assistance, pinning the last ribbon on her gown, when she heard carriage wheels crunching the gravel at the entrance.
"It's too early for Betsy," she thought,
and glancing out of the window, she caught sight of the carriage and the black hat of Alexei Alexandrovitch, and the ears she knew so well sticking up on each side of it.
"How unfortunate. Can he be going to stay the night?" she wondered, and the thought of what might come of such a possibility struck her as so awful and terrible that, without dwelling on it for a moment, she went down to meet him with a bright and radiant face. Unconscious of the presence of that spirit of falsehood and deceit in herself, which she had come to know of late, she abandoned herself to that spirit, and began talking, hardly knowing what she was saying.
"Oh, how nice of you," she said, giving her husband her hand, and greeting Sliudin, who was like one of the family, with a smile.
"You're staying for the night, I hope," was the first word the spirit of falsehood prompted her to utter. "And now we'll go together. Only it's a pity I've promised Betsy. She's coming for me."
Alexei Alexandrovitch knit his brows at Betsy's name.
"Oh, I'm not going to separate the inseparables," he said in his usual bantering tone. "I'm going with Mikhail Vasilievich. I'm ordered to exercise by the doctors, too. I'll walk, and imagine myself at the spa again."
"There's no hurry," said Anna. "Would you like tea?"
She rang.
"Bring in tea, and tell Seryozha that Alexei Alexandrovitch is here. Well, tell me, how have you been?"
"Mikhail Vasilievich, you've not been to see me before.
Look how lovely it is out on the terrace," she said, turning first to one and then to the other.
She spoke very simply and naturally, but too much and too fast. She was the more aware of this from noticing in the inquisitive look Mikhail Vasilievich turned on her that he was, as it were, keeping watch on her. Mikhail Vasilievich promptly went out onto the terrace. She sat down beside her husband.
"You don't look well," she said.
"Yes," he said. "The doctor's been with me today and wasted an hour of my time. I feel that one of our friends must have sent him. My health's so precious, it seems."
"No? What did he say?"
She questioned him about his health and what he had been doing, and tried to persuade him to take a rest and come stay with her. All this she said brightly, rapidly, and with a peculiar brilliance in her eyes. But Karenin didn't now attach any special significance to this tone of hers. He heard only her words, and gave them only the direct sense they bore, and he answered simply, though jesting. There was nothing singular in this conversation, but Anna could never recall this brief scene without an agonizing pang of shame. Seryozha came in, preceded by his governess. If Alexei Alexandrovitch had allowed himself to observe, he would have noticed the timid and bewildered eyes with which Seryozha glanced first at his father and then at his mother. But he would not see anything, and he didn't see it.
"Ah, the young man. He's grown. Really, he's getting to be quite a man. How are you, young man?"
And he gave his hand to the scared child. Seryozha had been shy of his father before, and now, ever since Alexei Alexandrovitch had begun calling him young man, and since that insoluble question had occurred to him whether Vronsky was a friend or a foe, he avoided his father. He looked around toward his mother as though seeking shelter. It was only with his mother that he was at ease. Meanwhile, Alexei Alexandrovitch was holding his son by the shoulder while he was speaking to the governess, and Seryozha was so miserably uncomfortable that Anna saw he was on the point of tears. Anna, who had flushed a little the instant her son came in, noticing that Seryozha was uncomfortable, got up hurriedly, took Alexei Alexandrovitch's hand from her son's shoulder, and kissing the boy, led him out onto the terrace and quickly came back.
"It's time to start, though," said she, glancing at her watch. "How is it Betsy doesn't come?"
"Yes," said Alexei Alexandrovitch, and getting up, he folded his hands and cracked his knuckles. "I've come to bring you some money, too, for nightingales, we know, can't live on fairy tales," he said. "You want it, I expect?"
"No, I don't." "Yes, I do," she said, not looking at him and crimsoning to the roots of her hair.
But you'll come back here after the races, I suppose.
Oh, yes, answered Alexei Alexandrovitch.
And here's the glory of Peterhof, Princess Tverskaya, he added, looking out of the window at the elegant English carriage with the tiny seats placed extremely high.
What elegance! Charming! Well, let us be starting too, then.
Princess Tverskaya didn't get out of her carriage, but her groom, in high boots, a cape, and black hat, darted out at the entrance.
I'm going. Goodbye, said Anna.
And kissing her son, she went up to Alexei Alexandrovitch and held out her hand to him.
It was so nice of you to come.
Alexei Alexandrovitch kissed her hand.
Well, goodbye, then. You'll come back for some tea. That's delightful, she said,
and went out gay and radiant. But as soon as she no longer saw him, she was aware of the spot on her hand that his lips had touched, and she shuddered with repulsion. Chapter 28 When Alexei Alexandrovitch reached the racetrack, Anna was already sitting in the pavilion beside Betsy, in that pavilion where all of the highest society had gathered. She caught sight of her husband in the distance. Two men, her husband and her lover, were the two centres of her existence, and unaided by her external senses, she was aware of their nearness. She was aware of her husband approaching a long way off, and she couldn't help following him in the surging crowd in the midst of which he was moving. She watched his progress toward the pavilion, saw him now responding condescendingly to an ingratiating bow, now exchanging friendly, nonchalant greetings with his equals, now assiduously trying to catch the eye of some great one of this world, and tipping his big round hat that squeezed the tips of his ears. All these ways of his she knew, and all were hateful to her. Nothing but ambition, nothing but the desire to get ahead, that's all there is in his soul, she thought. As for these lofty ideals, love of culture, religion, they are only so many tools for advancing. From his glances towards the ladies' pavilion, he was staring straight at her, but didn't distinguish his wife in the sea of muslin, ribbons, feathers, parasols, and flowers. She saw that he was looking for her, but she purposely avoided noticing him.
"Alexei Alexandrovitch," Princess Betsy called to him. "I'm sure you don't see your wife. Here she is."
He smiled his chilly smile.
"There's so much splendour here that one's eyes are dazzled," he said, and he went into the pavilion.
He smiled to his wife as a man should smile on meeting his wife after only just parting from her, and greeted the princess and other acquaintances, giving to each what was due, that is to say, jesting with the ladies, and dealing out friendly greetings among the men. Below, near the pavilion, was standing an adjutant-general of whom Alexei Alexandrovitch had a high opinion, noted for his intelligence and culture. Karenin entered into conversation with him. There was an interval between the races, and so nothing hindered conversation. The adjutant-general expressed his disapproval of races. Karenin replied, defending them. Anna heard his high, measured tones, not losing one word, and every word struck her as false, and stabbed her ears with pain. When the three-mile steeplechase was beginning, she bent forward and gazed with fixed eyes at Vronsky as he went up to his horse and mounted, and at the same time she heard that loathsome, never-ceasing voice of her husband. She was in an agony of terror for Vronsky, but a still greater agony was the never-ceasing, as it seemed to her, stream of her husband's shrill voice with its familiar intonations. "I'm a wicked woman, a lost woman," she thought. "But I don't like lying. I can't endure falsehood. While as for him, her husband, it's the breath of his life, falsehood. He knows all about it. He sees it all. What does he care if he can talk so calmly? If he were to kill me, if he were to kill Vronsky, I might respect him. No, all he wants is falsehood and propriety," Anna said to herself, not considering exactly what it was she wanted of her husband, and how she would have liked to see him behave. She didn't understand either that his peculiar loquacity that day, so exasperating to her, was merely the expression of his inward distress and uneasiness. As a child that has been hurt skips about, putting all his muscles into movement to drown the pain. In the same way, Alexei Alexandrovich needed mental exercise to drown the thoughts of his wife, which in her presence and in Vronsky's, and with all the continual iteration of his name, would force themselves on his attention. And it was as natural for him to talk well and cleverly as it is natural for a child to skip about. He was saying,
"Danger in the races of officers, of cavalrymen, is an essential element in the race. If England can point to the most brilliant feats of cavalry in military history, it's simply due to the fact that she has historically developed this force both in beasts and in men. Sport has, in my opinion, a great value, and, as is always the case, we see nothing but what is most superficial."
"It's not superficial," said Princess Tverskaya.
"One of the officers, they say, has broken two ribs."
Alexei Alexandrovich smiled his smile, which uncovered his teeth, but revealed nothing more.
"We'll admit, Princess, that that's not superficial," he said, "but internal.
But that's not the point."
And he turned again to the general with whom he was talking seriously.
"We mustn't forget that those who are taking part in the race are military men who have chosen that career. And one must allow that every calling has its disagreeable side. It forms an integral part of the duties of an officer. Sports, such as prize-fighting or Spanish bullfights, disgraceful sports, are a sign of barbarity. But specialized trials of skill are a sign of progress."
"No, I shan't come another time. It's too exciting," said Princess Betsy.
"Isn't it, Anna?"
"It is exciting, but one can't tear oneself away," said another lady. "If I'd been a Roman woman, I would never have missed a single circus."
Anna said nothing, keeping her binoculars focused always on the same spot. At that moment, a tall general walked through the pavilion. Breaking off what he was saying, Alexei Alexandrovich got up hurriedly, though with dignity, and bowed low to the general.
"You're not racing?"
the officer asked, chaffing him.
"My race is a harder one,"
Alexei Alexandrovich responded deferentially. And though the answer meant nothing, the general looked as though he had heard a witty remark from a witty man, and fully relished la pointe de la sauce.
"There are two aspects," Alexei Alexandrovich resumed. "Those who take part, and those who look on. And love for such spectacles is an unmistakable proof of a low degree of development in the spectator, I admit, but..."
"Princess?"
"Bets,"
sounded Stepan Arkadyevich's voice from below, addressing Betsy.
"Who's your favourite?"
"Anna and I are for Kozofliov," replied Betsy.
"I'm for Vronsky.
A pair of gloves?"
"Done."
"But it's a pretty sight, isn't it?"
Alexei Alexandrovich paused while they were talking about him, but he began again immediately.
"I admit that manly sports do not..."
he was continuing. But at that moment the racers started, and all conversation ceased. Alexei Alexandrovich, too, was silent, and everyone stood up and turned toward the stream. Alexei Alexandrovich took no interest in the race, and so he didn't watch the racers, but began listlessly scanning the spectators with his weary eyes. His eyes rested upon Anna. Her face was white and set. She was obviously seeing nothing and no one but one man. Her hand had convulsively clutched her fan, and she held her breath. He looked at her, and hastily turned away, scrutinizing other faces.
"But here's this lady, too, and others very much moved as well. It's very natural," Alexei Alexandrovich told himself.
He tried not to look at her, but unconsciously his eyes were drawn to her. He examined that face again, trying not to read what was so plainly written on it, and against his own will, with horror, he read on it what he didn't want to know. The first fall, Kozofliov's at the stream, agitated everyone, but Alexei Alexandrovich saw distinctly on Anna's pale, triumphant face that the man she was watching had not fallen. When, after Mokhotin and Vronsky had cleared the worst barrier, the next officer had been thrown straight on his head at it and fatally injured, and a shudder of horror passed over the whole crowd, Alexei Alexandrovich saw that Anna didn't even notice it, and had some difficulty in realizing what they were talking about all around her. But more and more often, and with greater persistence, He watched her. Anna, wholly engrossed as she was with the race, became aware of her husband's cold eyes fixed upon her from one side. She glanced around for an instant, looked inquiringly at him, and with a slight frown, turned away again. "Oh, I don't care," she seemed to say to him, and she didn't once glance at him again. The race was an unlucky one, and of the 17 officers who rode in it, more than half were thrown and hurt. Toward the end of the race, everyone was in a state of agitation, which was intensified by the fact that the Tsar was displeased. Chapter 29. Everyone was loudly expressing disapprobation. Everyone was repeating a phrase someone had uttered.
The lions and gladiators will be the next thing.
And everyone was feeling horrified. So that when Vronsky fell to the ground and Anna moaned aloud, there was nothing very unusual about it. But afterwards a change came over Anna's face which really was beyond decorum. She utterly lost her head. She began fluttering like a caged bird, at one moment getting up as if to go, at the next turning to Betsy. "Let us go, let us go," she said. But Betsy didn't hear her. She was bending down, talking to a general who had come up to her. Alexei Alexandrovitch went up to Anna and courteously offered his arm.
"Let us go, if you like," he said in French.
But Anna was listening to the general and didn't notice her husband.
"He's broken his leg too, so they say,"
the general was saying.
"This is too much."
Without answering her husband, Anna lifted her binoculars and gazed toward the place where Vronsky had fallen, but it was so far off, and there was such a crowd of people around it, that she could make out nothing. She laid down the binoculars, about to move away, but at that moment an officer galloped up and made some announcement to the Tsar. Anna craned forward, listening. "Stiva! Stiva!" she cried to her brother. But her brother didn't hear her. Again she started to leave.
"Once more I offer you my arm, if you wish to leave," said Alexei Alexandrovitch, reaching toward her hand.
She drew back from him with aversion, and without looking in his face, she answered, "No, no, let me be. I'll stay." She saw now that from the place of Vronsky's accident, an officer was running across the course toward the pavilion. Betsy waved her handkerchief to him. The officer brought the news that the rider was not killed, but the horse had broken its back. On hearing this, Anna sat down hurriedly and hid her face in her fan. Alexei Alexandrovitch saw that she was weeping and couldn't control her tears, nor even the sobs that were shaking her bosom.
Alexei Alexandrovitch stood so as to screen her, giving her time to recover herself. "For the third time, I offer you my arm," he said to her, after a little while, turning to her.
Anna gazed at him and didn't know what to say. Princess Betsy came to her rescue.
"No, Alexei Alexandrovitch. I brought Anna, and I promised to take her home," Betsy said.
"Excuse me, Princess," he said, smiling courteously but looking her very firmly in the face. "But I see that Anna's not very well, and I wish her to come home with me."
Anna looked about her in a frightened way, got up submissively, and laid her hand on her husband's arm.
"I'll send to him and find out, and let you know," Betsy whispered to her.
As they left the pavilion, Alexei Alexandrovitch, as always, talked to those he met, and Anna had, as always, to talk and answer. But she was utterly beside herself, and moved, hanging on her husband's arm, as though in a dream. "Is he killed or not? Is it true? Will he come or not? Shall I see him today?" she was thinking. She took her seat in her husband's carriage in silence, and in silence drove out of the crowd of carriages. In spite of all he had seen, Alexei Alexandrovitch still didn't allow himself to consider his wife's real condition. He merely saw the outward symptoms. He saw that she was behaving unbecomingly, and considered it his duty to tell her so. But it was very difficult for him not to say more, to tell her nothing but that. He opened his mouth to tell her she had behaved unbecomingly, but he couldn't help saying something utterly different.
"What an inclination we have, though, for these cruel spectacles," he said. "I observe—"
"What? I don't understand," said Anna contemptuously. He was offended, and at once began to say what he had meant to say.
"I'm obliged to tell you," he began.
"So now we are to have it out," she thought, and she felt frightened.
"I'm obliged to tell you that your behaviour has been unbecoming today,"
he said to her in French. "In what way has my behaviour been unbecoming?" she said aloud, turning her head swiftly and looking him straight in the face, not with the bright expression that seemed masking something, but with a look of determination under which she concealed with difficulty the dismay she was feeling.
"Careful," he said, pointing to the open window opposite the coachman.
He got up and pulled up the window. "What did you consider unbecoming?" she repeated.
"The despair you were unable to conceal at the accident to one of the riders."
He waited for her to answer, but she was silent, looking straight before her.
"I have already begged you so to conduct yourself in society that even malicious tongues can find nothing to say against you. There was a time when I spoke of your inward attitude, but I am not speaking of that now. Now I speak only of your external attitude. You have behaved improperly, and I would wish it not to occur again."
She didn't hear half of what he was saying. She felt panic-stricken before him, and was wondering whether it was true that Vronsky was not killed. Was it of him they were speaking when they said the rider was unhurt but the horse had broken its back? She merely smiled with a pretense of irony when he finished, and made no reply, because she hadn't heard what he said. Alexei Alexandrovitch had begun to speak boldly, but as he realized plainly what he was speaking of, the dismay she was feeling infected him too. He saw the smile, and a strange misapprehension came over him.
"She's smiling at my suspicions. Yes, she will tell me now what she told me before, that there is no foundation for my suspicions, that it's absurd."
At that moment, when the revelation of everything was hanging over him, there was nothing he expected so much as that she would answer mockingly as before, that his suspicions were absurd and utterly groundless. So terrible to him was that which he knew, that now he was ready to believe anything. But the expression of her face, scared and gloomy, didn't now promise even deception.
"Possibly I was mistaken," said he. "If so, I beg your pardon."
"No, you were not mistaken," she said deliberately, looking desperately into his cold face. "You were not mistaken. I was, and I could not help being in despair. I hear you, but I'm thinking of him. I love him. I'm his mistress. I can't bear you. I'm afraid of you, and I hate you. You can do what you like to me." And dropping back into the corner of the carriage, she broke into sobs, hiding her face in her hands. Alexei Alexandrovitch didn't stir, and kept looking straight before him. But his whole face suddenly bore the solemn rigidity of the dead, and his expression didn't change during the whole time of the drive home. On reaching the house, he turned his head to her, still with the same expression.
"Very well. But I expect a strict observance of the external forms of propriety, till such time—"
his voice shook—
"as I may take measures to protect my honour and communicate them to you."
He got out first and helped her to get out. Before the servants he pressed her hand, took his seat in the carriage, and drove back to Petersburg. Immediately afterwards a footman came from Princess Betsy and brought Anna a note. "I sent to Alexei to find out how he is, and he writes me he is quite well and unhurt, but in despair." "So he will be here," she thought. "What a good thing I told him everything." She glanced at her watch. She still had 3 hours to wait, and the memories of their last meetings set her blood in flame. "My God, how light it is! It's dreadful, but I love to see his face, and I love this fantastic light."
"My husband. Oh, yes.
Well, thank God everything's over with him.
Chapter 30. In the little German spa to which the Shishchabatskys had come, as in all places where people are gathered together, the usual process, as it were, of the crystallization of society went on, assigning to each member of that society a definite and unalterable place. Just as the particle of water in frost definitely and unalterably takes a special form of the crystal of snow, so each new person who arrived at the spa was at once placed in his special place. Prince Shishchabatsky, with his wife and daughter, by the apartments they took, and from their name and the friends they made, were immediately crystallized into a definite place marked out for them. Visiting the spa that year was a real German Fürsten, in consequence of which the crystallizing process went on more vigorously than ever. Princess Shishchabatsky wished, above all, to present her daughter to this German princess, and the day after their arrival she duly performed this rite. Kitty made a low and graceful curtsy in the very simple, that is to say, very elegant frock that had been ordered for her from Paris. The German princess said,
"I hope the roses will soon come back to this pretty little face."
And for the Shishchabatskys, certain definite lines of existence were at once laid down from which there was no departing. The Shishchabatskys made the acquaintance, too, of the family of an English lady, of a German countess and her son, wounded in the last war, of a learned Swede, and of Mr. Canute and his sister. But yet, inevitably, the Shishchabatskys were thrown most into the society of a Moscow lady, Maria Yevgenyevna Ritisheva, and her daughter, whom Kitty disliked because she had fallen ill, like herself, over a love affair, and a Moscow colonel, whom Kitty had known from childhood, and always seen in uniforms and epaulettes, and who now, with his little eyes and his open neck and flowered cravat, was unusually ridiculous and tedious, because there was no getting rid of him. When all this was so firmly established, Kitty began to be very much bored, especially as the prince went away to Carlsbad, and she was left alone with her mother. She took no interest in the people she knew, feeling that nothing fresh would come of them. Her chief interest in the spa consisted in watching and making theories about the people she didn't know. It was characteristic of Kitty that she always saw people in the most favourable light possible, especially those she didn't know. And now, as she made surmises as to who people were, what their relations were to one another, and what they were like, Kitty endowed them with the most marvellous and noble characters, and found confirmation of her idea in her observations. Of these people, the one that attracted her most was a Russian girl who had come to the spa with an invalid Russian lady, Madame Stahl, as everyone called her. Madame Stahl belonged to the higher society, but she was so ill that she couldn't walk, and only on exceptionally fine days she made her appearance at the spa in a wheelchair. But it was not so much from ill health as from pride, so Princess Shishchabatsky interpreted it, that Madame Stahl had not made the acquaintance of anyone among the Russians there. The Russian girl looked after Madame Stahl, and besides that, she was, as Kitty observed, on friendly terms with all the invalids who were seriously ill, and there were many of them at the spa, and looked after them in the most natural way. This Russian girl was not, as Kitty gathered, related to Madame Stahl, nor was she a paid attendant. Madame Stahl called her Varenka, and other people called her Mademoiselle Varenka. Apart from the interest Kitty took in this girl's relations with Madame Stahl and with the other unknown persons, as often happened, she felt an inexplicable attraction to Mademoiselle Varenka, and was aware, when their eyes met, that she too liked her. Of Mademoiselle Varenka it could be said that she had passed her first youth, but that she seemed a creature without youth. She might have been taken for 19, or for 30. If her features were examined separately, she was good-looking rather than plain, in spite of the sickly hue of her face. She would have had a good figure, too, if it had not been for her extreme thinness and the size of her head, which was too large for her medium height. But she was not likely to be attractive to men. She was like a fine flower already past its bloom and without fragrance, though the petals were still unwithered. Moreover, she would have been unattractive to men also from the lack of just what Kitty had too much of the suppressed fire of vitality, and the consciousness of her own attractiveness. She always seemed absorbed in work about which there could be no doubt, and so it seemed she couldn't take interest in anything outside it. It was just this contrast with her own position that was, for Kitty, the great attraction of Mademoiselle Varenka. Kitty felt that in her manner of life, she would find an example of what she was now so painfully seeking, interest in life, a dignity in life, apart from the worldly relations of girls with men, which so revolted her, and appeared to her now as a shameful hawking about of goods in search of a purchaser. The more attentively Kitty watched her unknown friend, the more convinced she was that this girl was the perfect creature she imagined her to be, and the more eagerly she wished to make her acquaintance. The two girls used to meet several times a day, and every time they met, Kitty's eyes said, "Who are you? What are you? Are you really the exquisite creature I imagine you to be? But for goodness sake, don't suppose," her eyes added, "that I would force my acquaintance on you. I simply admire you, and like you."
"I like you, too, and you're very, very sweet. And I would like you better still if I had time," answered the eyes of the unknown girl. Kitty saw, indeed, that she was always busy. Either she was taking the children of a Russian family home from the spa, or fetching a comforter for a sick lady and wrapping her up in it, or trying to interest an irritable invalid, or selecting and buying cakes for tea for someone. Soon after the arrival of the Shishchobatskys, there appeared in the morning crowd at the spa two persons who attracted universal and unfavourable attention. These were a tall man with a stooping figure and huge hands, in an old coat too short for him, with black, simple, and yet terrible eyes, and a pock-marked, kind-looking woman, very badly and tastelessly dressed. Recognizing these persons as Russians, Kitty had already in her imagination begun constructing a delightful and touching romance about them. But the princess, having ascertained from the visitors' list that this was Nikolai Levin and Maria Nikolaevna, explained to Kitty what a bad man this Levin was, and all her dreams about these two people vanished. Not so much from what her mother told her, as from the fact that it was Konstantin's brother, this pair suddenly seemed to Kitty intensely unpleasant. This Levin, with his continual twitching of his head, aroused in her now an irrepressible feeling of disgust. It seemed to her that his big, terrible eyes, which persistently pursued her, expressed a feeling of hatred and contempt, and she tried to avoid meeting him. Chapter 31. It was a wet day. It had been raining all morning, and the invalids, with their parasols, had flocked into the arcades. Kitty was walking there with her mother and the Moscow colonel, smart and jaunty in his European coat, bought ready-made in Frankfurt. They were walking on one side of the arcade, trying to avoid Levin, who was walking on the other side. Varenka, in her dark dress, in a black hat with a turn-down brim, was walking up and down the whole length of the arcade with a blind Frenchwoman. And every time she met Kitty, they exchanged friendly glances.
"Mama, couldn't I speak to her?" said Kitty, watching her unknown friend, and noticing that she was going up to the spa, and that they might come down there together.
"Oh, if you want to so much. I'll find out about her first, and make her acquaintance myself," answered her mother. "What do you see in her that's so unusual? A companion she must be. If you like, I'll make acquaintance with Madame Stahl. I used to know her belle sœur," added the princess, lifting her head haughtily. Kitty knew that the princess was offended that Madame Stahl had seemed to avoid making her acquaintance. Kitty didn't insist.
"How wonderfully sweet she is," she said, gazing at Varenka, just as she handed a glass to the Frenchwoman. "Look how natural and sweet it all is."
"It's so funny to see your infatuations," said the princess. "No, we'd better go back," she added, noticing Levin coming toward them with his companion and a German doctor, to whom he was talking very noisily and angrily.
They turned to go back, when suddenly they heard not noisy talk, but shouting. Levin, stopping short, was shouting at the doctor, and the doctor, too, was excited. A crowd gathered around them. The princess and Kitty beat a hasty retreat, while the colonel joined the crowd to find out what was the matter. A few minutes later, the colonel overtook them.
"What was it?"
inquired the princess.
"Scandalous and disgraceful," answered the colonel. "The one thing to be dreaded is meeting Russians abroad. That tall gentleman was abusing the doctor, flinging all sorts of insults at him because he wasn't treating him quite as he liked, and he began waving his stick at him. It's simply a scandal."
"Oh, how unpleasant," said the princess.
"Well, and how did it end?"
"Luckily, at that point, the one in the mushroom hat intervened. A Russian lady, I think she is," said the colonel.
"Mademoiselle Varenka?" asked Kitty.
"Yes, yes. She came to the rescue before anyone. She took the man by the arm and led him away."
"There, Mama," said Kitty. "You wonder that I'm enthusiastic about her." The next day, as she watched her unknown friend, Kitty noticed that Mademoiselle Varenka was already on the same terms with Levin and his companion as with her other protégés. She went up to them, entered into conversation with them, and served as interpreter for the woman who couldn't speak any foreign language. Kitty began to entreat her mother still more urgently to let her make friends with Varenka. And disagreeable as it was to the princess to seem to take the first step in wishing to make the acquaintance of Madame Stahl, who thought fit to put on airs, she made inquiries about Varenka, and having ascertained particulars about her tending to prove that there could be no harm, though little good, in the acquaintance, she herself approached Varenka and introduced herself. Choosing a time when her daughter had gone to the spa, while Varenka had stopped outside the baker's, the princess went up to her.
"Allow me to make your acquaintance," she said with her dignified smile. "My daughter has lost her heart to you," she said. "Possibly you do not know me. I am..."
"That feeling is more than reciprocal, princess," Varenka answered hurriedly.
"What a good deed you did yesterday for our poor compatriot," said the princess.
Varenka flushed a little. "I don't remember. I don't think I did anything," she said.
"Why, you saved that Levin from disagreeable consequences."
"Yes, his companion called me, and I tried to pacify him. He's very ill, and was dissatisfied with the doctor. I'm used to looking after such invalids."
"Yes, I've heard you live at Montone with your aunt. I think Madame Stahl? I used to know her belle sœur."
"No, she's not my aunt. I call her Mama, but I'm not related to her. I was brought up by her," answered Varenka, flushing a little again. This was so simply said, and so sweet was the truthful and candid expression of her face, that the princess saw why Kitty had taken such a liking to Varenka.
"Well, and what's this Levin going to do?" asked the princess.
"He's going away," answered Varenka. At that instant Kitty came up from the spa, beaming with delight that her mother had become acquainted with her unknown friend.
"Well, see, Kitty, your intense desire to make friends with Mademoiselle—"
"Varenka," Varenka offered, smiling. "That's what everyone calls me." Kitty blushed with pleasure, and slowly, without speaking, pressed her new friend's hand, which didn't respond to her pressure, but lay motionless in her hand. The hand didn't respond to her pressure, but Mademoiselle Varenka's face glowed with a soft, glad, though rather mournful smile that showed large but handsome teeth.
"I've long wished for this, too," she said.
"But you're so busy."
"Oh, no, I'm not at all busy," answered Varenka.
But at that moment she had to leave her new friends, because two little Russian girls, children of an invalid, ran up to her.
"Varenka, Mama's calling," they cried.
And Varenka went after them. Chapter 32 The particulars which the princess had learned in regard to Varenka's past and her relations with Madame Stahl were as follows. Madame Stahl, of whom some people said that she had worried her husband to death, while others said it was he who had made her wretched by his immoral behaviour, had always been a woman of weak health and hysterical temperament. When, after her separation from her husband, she gave birth to her only child, the child had died almost immediately, and the family of Madame Stahl, knowing her sensibility and fearing the news would kill her, had substituted another child, a baby born the same night and in the same house in Petersburg, the daughter of the chief cook of the palace. This was Varenka. Madame Stahl learned later on that Varenka was not her own child, but she continued bringing her up, especially because very soon afterwards Varenka had not a relation of her own living. Madame Stahl had now been living more than 10 years continuously abroad, in the south, never leaving her couch. And some people said that she had made her social position as a philanthropic, highly religious woman. Other people said she really was at heart the highly ethical being, living for nothing but the good of her fellow creatures, which she represented herself to be. No one knew what her faith was, Catholic, Protestant, or Greek Orthodox. But one fact was indubitable. She was in amicable relations with the highest dignitaries of all the churches and sects. Varenka lived with her all the while abroad, and everyone who knew Madame Stahl knew and liked Mademoiselle Varenka, as everyone called her. Having learned all these facts, the princess found nothing to object to in her daughter's intimacy with Varenka, especially since Varenka's breeding and education were of the best. She spoke French and English extremely well, and, what was of the most weight, brought a message from Madame Stahl expressing her regret that she was prevented by her ill health from making the acquaintance of the princess. After getting to know Varenka, Kitty became more and more fascinated by her friend, and every day she discovered new virtues in her. The princess, hearing that Varenka had a good voice, asked her to come and sing to them in the evening.
"Kitty plays, and we have a piano. Not a good one, it's true, but you will give us so much pleasure," said the princess with her affected smile, which Kitty disliked particularly just then, because she noticed that Varenka had no inclination to sing. Varenka came, however, in the evening, and brought a roll of music with her. The princess had invited Maria Yevgenyevna and her daughter and the colonel. Varenka seemed quite unaffected by there being persons present she didn't know, and she went right to the piano. She couldn't accompany herself, but she could read music very well. Kitty, who played well, accompanied her.
"You have an extraordinary talent," the princess said to her after Varenka had sung the first song extremely well.
Maria Yevgenyevna and her daughter expressed their thanks and admiration.
"Look," said the colonel, looking out of the window, "what an audience has collected to listen to you."
There actually was quite a considerable crowd under the windows.
"I'm very glad it gives you pleasure," Varenka answered simply.
Kitty looked with pride at her friend. She was enchanted by her talent, and her voice, and her face, but most of all by her manner. By the way, Varenka obviously thought nothing of her singing, and was quite unmoved by their praises. She seemed only to be asking, "Am I to sing again, or is that enough?"
"If it had been me," thought Kitty, "how proud I would have been. How delighted I would have been to see that crowd under the windows. But she's utterly unmoved by it. Her only motive is to avoid refusing and to please Mama. What is there in her? What is it that gives her the power to disregard everything, to be calm independently of everything? How I should like to know it and to learn it from her," thought Kitty, gazing into her serene face.
The princess asked Varenka to sing again, and Varenka sang another song, also smoothly, distinctly, and well, standing erect at the piano and beating time on it with her thin, dark-skinned hand. The next song in the book was an Italian one. Kitty played the opening bars and looked round at Varenka.
"Let's skip that," said Varenka, flushing a little.
Kitty let her eyes rest on Varenka's face with a look of dismay and inquiry.
"Very well, the next one," she said hurriedly, turning over the pages, and at once feeling that there was something connected with the song.
"No," answered Varenka with a smile, laying her hand on the music. "No, let's have that one." And she sang it just as quietly, as coolly, and as well as the others. When she'd finished, they all thanked her again and went off to tea. Kitty and Varenka went out into the little garden that adjoined the house.
"Am I right that you have some memories connected with that song?" said Kitty. "Don't tell me about it," she added hastily.
Only say if I'm right.
No, why not? I'll tell you, said Varenka simply, and without waiting for a reply, she went on. Yes, it brings back memories, painful ones. I loved someone once, and I used to sing him that song. Kitty, with big, wide-open eyes, gazed silently, sympathetically at Varenka. I loved him, and he loved me, but his mother didn't wish it, and he married another girl. He lives not far from us, and I see him sometimes. You didn't think I had a love affair, too, did you? She said. And there was a faint gleam in her beautiful face of that fire which Kitty felt must once have glowed all over her.
I didn't think so. Why, if I were a man, I could never care for anyone else after knowing you. Only I can't understand how he could, to please his mother, forget you and make you unhappy. He had no heart.
Oh, no. He's a very good man. And I'm not unhappy. Quite the contrary. I'm very happy.
Well, so we shan't be singing any more now, she added, turning toward the house.
How good you are! How good you are! Cried Kitty. And stopping her, she kissed her. If I could only be even a little like you.
Why should you be like anyone? You're nice as you are, said Varenka, smiling her gentle, weary smile.
No, I'm not nice at all. Come, tell me. Stop a minute, let's sit down, said Kitty, making her sit down again beside her.
Tell me, isn't it humiliating to think that a man has disdained your love, that he hasn't cared for it?
But he didn't disdain it. I believe he cared for me, but he was a dutiful son.
Yes, but if it hadn't been on account of his mother, if it had been his own doing, said Kitty, feeling she was giving away her secret, and that her face, burning with the flush of shame, had betrayed her already.
In that case he would have done wrong, and I would not have regretted him, answered Varenka, evidently realizing that they were now talking not of her, but of Kitty.
But the humiliation, said Kitty, the humiliation one can never forget.
Can never forget, she said, remembering her expression at the last ball during the pause in the music.
Where is the humiliation? Why? You did nothing wrong.
Worse than wrong. Shameful. Varenka shook her head and laid her hand on Kitty's hand.
Why? What is there shameful? She said. You didn't tell a man who didn't care for you that you loved him, did you?
Of course not. I never said a word, but he knew it.
No, no, there are looks, there are ways.
I can't forget it if I live 100 years.
Why?
I don't understand.
The whole point is whether you love him now or not, said Varenka, who called everything by its name.
I hate him.
I can't forgive myself.
Why? What for?
The shame.
The humiliation.
Oh, if everyone were as sensitive as you are, said Varenka. There isn't a girl who hasn't been through the same, and it's all so unimportant.
Why, what's important? Said Kitty, looking into her face with inquisitive wonder.
Oh, there's so much that's important, said Varenka, smiling.
Why? What?
Oh, so much that's more important, answered Varenka, not knowing what to say.
But at that instant, they heard the princess's voice from the window.
Kitty, it's cold. Either get a shawl or come indoors.
It really is time to go in, said Varenka, getting up.
I have to go on to Madame Berthe's. She asked me to.
Kitty held her by the hand, and with passionate curiosity and entreaty, her eyes asked her,
What is it? What is this of such importance that gives you such tranquillity? You know. Tell me.
But Varenka didn't even know what Kitty's eyes were asking her. She merely thought that she had to go to see Madame Berthe, too, that evening, and to hurry home in time for Maman's tea at 12 o'clock. She went indoors, collected her music, and saying goodbye to everyone, prepared to leave.
Allow me to see you home, said the colonel.
Yes, how can you go alone at night like this? The princess chimed in.
Anyway, I'll send Parasha.
Kitty saw that Varenka could hardly restrain a smile at the idea that she needed an escort.
"No, I always go about alone, and nothing ever happens to me," she said, taking her hat.
And kissing Kitty once more, without saying what was important, she stepped out vigorously with the music under her arm and vanished into the twilight of the summer night, bearing away with her her secret of what was important and what gave her the calm and dignity so much to be envied. Chapter 33 Kitty made the acquaintance of Madame Stahl, too, and this acquaintance, together with her friendship with Varenka, didn't merely exercise a great influence on her, it also comforted her in her mental distress. She found this comfort through a completely new world being opened to her by means of this acquaintance, a world having nothing in common with her past, an exalted, noble world, from the height of which she could contemplate her past calmly. It was revealed to her that beside the instinctive life to which Kitty had given herself up till now, there was a spiritual life. This life was disclosed in religion, but a religion having nothing in common with that one Kitty had known from childhood, and which found expression in masses and vespers at the widow's home, where one might meet one's friends, and in learning by heart Slavonic texts with the priest. This was a lofty, mysterious religion connected with a whole series of noble thoughts and feelings, which one could do more than believe merely because one was told to, which one could love. Kitty found all this out not from words. Madame Stahl talked to Kitty as to a charming child that one looks on with pleasure as on the memories of one's youth, and only once she said in passing that in all human sorrows nothing gives comfort but love and faith, and that in the sight of Christ's compassion for us, no sorrow is trifling, and immediately talked of other things. But in every gesture of Madame Stahl, in every word, in every heavenly, as Kitty called it, look, and above all, in the whole story of her life, which she heard from Varenka, Kitty recognized that something that was important, of which till then she had known nothing. Yet, elevated as Madame Stahl's character was, touching as was her story, and exalted and moving as was her speech, Kitty couldn't help detecting in her some traits that perplexed her. She noticed that when questioning her about her family, Madame Stahl had smiled contemptuously, which was not in accord with Christian meekness. She noticed, too, that when she had found a Catholic priest with her, Madame Stahl had studiously kept her face in the shadow of the lampshade, and had smiled in a peculiar way. Trivial as these two observations were, they perplexed her, and she had her doubts about Madame Stahl. But on the other hand, Varenka, alone in the world, without friends or relations, with a melancholy disappointment in the past, desiring nothing, regretting nothing, was just that perfection of which Kitty dared hardly dream. In Varenka she realized that one has but to forget oneself and love others, and one will be calm, happy, and noble. And that was what Kitty longed to be. Seeing now clearly what was the most important, Kitty was not satisfied with being enthusiastic over it. She at once surrendered her whole soul to the new life that was opening for her. From Varenka's accounts of the doings of Madame Stahl and other people whom she mentioned, Kitty had already constructed the plan of her own future life. She would, like Madame Stahl's niece Alina, of whom Varenka had talked a great deal, seek out those who were in trouble, wherever she might be living, help them as far as she could, distribute gospels, read the gospel to the sick, the criminals, the dying. The idea of reading the gospel to criminals, as Alina did, particularly fascinated Kitty. But all these were secret dreams, of which Kitty didn't talk either to her mother or to Varenka. While awaiting the time for carrying out her plans on a large scale, however, Kitty readily found a chance for practicing her new principles in imitation of Varenka at the spa, where there were so many people ill and unhappy. At first the princess noticed nothing but that Kitty was much under the influence of her infatuation, as she called it, for Madame Stahl, and still more for Varenka. She saw that Kitty didn't merely imitate Varenka in her conduct, but unconsciously imitated her in her manner of walking, of talking, of blinking her eyes, But later on, the princess noticed that apart from this adoration, some kind of serious spiritual change was taking place in her daughter. The princess saw that in the evenings, Kitty read the Gospels in French that Madame Stahl had given her, a thing she'd never done before, that she avoided society acquaintances and associated with the sick people who were under Varenka's protection, and especially one poor family, that of a sick painter, Petrov. Kitty was unmistakably proud of playing the part of a sister of mercy in that family. All this was well enough, and the princess had nothing to say against it, especially as Petrov's wife was a perfectly nice sort of woman, and the German princess, noticing Kitty's devotion, praised her, calling her an angel of consolation. All this would have been very well if Kitty hadn't overdone it, but the princess saw that her daughter was rushing into extremes, and told her so.
"Never overdo anything," she said to her.
Her daughter made no reply, but in her heart she thought that one couldn't talk about overdoing it where Christianity was concerned. How could one go too far in the practice of a doctrine wherein one was bidden to turn the other cheek when one was smitten, and give one's cloak if one's coat were taken? But the princess disliked this extreme behaviour, and disliked even more the fact that she felt her daughter didn't care to reveal her whole heart to her. Kitty did, in fact, conceal her new views and feelings from her mother. She concealed them not because she didn't respect or didn't love her mother, but simply because she was her mother. She would have revealed them to anyone sooner than to her mother.
"Why is it Anna Pavlovna's not been to see us for so long?" the princess said one day of Madame Petrova. "I've asked her, but she seems disturbed about something."
"No, I've not noticed it, Maman," said Kitty, flushing hotly.
"Is it long since you went to see them?"
"We intend to make an expedition to the mountains tomorrow," Kitty answered.
"Well, you can go," the princess said, gazing at her daughter's embarrassed face, and trying to guess the cause of her embarrassment.
That day Varenka came to dinner and told them that Anna Pavlovna had changed her mind and given up the expedition for the morrow, and the princess noticed again that Kitty reddened.
"Kitty, haven't you had some misunderstanding with the Petrovs?" said the princess when they were left alone. "Why has she given up the idea of sending the children and coming to see us?"
Kitty answered that nothing had happened between them, and that she couldn't tell why Anna Pavlovna seemed displeased with her. Kitty answered perfectly truly. She didn't know the reason Anna Pavlovna had changed toward her, but she guessed it. She guessed at something which she couldn't tell her mother, which she didn't put into words to herself. It was one of those things which one knows, but which one can never speak of, even to oneself. So terrible and shameful would it be to be mistaken. Again and again she went over in her memory all her relations with the family. She remembered the simple delight expressed on the round, good-humoured face of Anna Pavlovna at their meetings. She remembered their secret consultations about the invalid, their plots to draw him away from the work which was forbidden him, and to get him out of doors. The devotion of the youngest boy, who used to call her "My Kitty," and wouldn't go to bed without her. How nice it all was! Then she recalled the thin, terribly thin figure of Petrov, with his long neck, in his brown coat, his thin curly hair, his questioning blue eyes that were so terrible to Kitty at first, and his painful attempts to seem hearty and lively in her presence. She recalled the efforts she had made at first to overcome the repugnance she felt for him, as for all consumptive people, and the pains it had cost her to think of things to say to him. She recalled the timid, softened look with which he gazed at her, and the strange feeling of compassion and awkwardness, and later of a sense of her own goodness which she had felt at it. How nice it all was! But all that was at first. Now, a few days ago, everything was suddenly spoiled. Anna Pavlovna had met Kitty with affected cordiality, and had kept continual watch on her and on her husband. Could that touching pleasure he showed when she came near be the cause of Anna Pavlovna's coolness? "Yes," she mused. There was something unnatural about Anna Pavlovna,
and utterly unlike her good nature when she said angrily the day before yesterday, "There, he will keep waiting for you. He wouldn't drink his coffee without you, though he's grown so dreadfully weak." Yes, perhaps, too, she didn't like it when I gave him the comforter. It was all so simple, but he took it so awkwardly and was so long thanking me that I felt awkward, too. And then that portrait of me he did so well. And most of all, that look of confusion and tenderness. "Yes, yes, that's it," Kitty repeated to herself with horror. "No, it can't be. It shouldn't be. He's so much to be pitied," she said to herself very soon after. This doubt poisoned the charm of her new life. Chapter 34. Before the end of the season at the Spa, Prince Chechabatsky, who had gone on from Carlsbad to Baden, and Kissingen to Russian friends, to get a breath of Russian air, as he said, came back to his wife and daughter. The views of the prince and of the princess on life abroad were completely opposed. The princess thought everything delightful, and in spite of her established position in Russian society, she tried abroad to be like a fashionable European lady, which she was not, for the simple reason that she was a typical Russian gentlewoman, and so she was affected, which did not altogether suit her. The prince, on the contrary, thought everything foreign detestable, got sick of European life, kept to his Russian habits, and purposely tried to appear less European than he was in reality. The prince returned thinner, with the skin hanging in loose bags on his cheeks, but in the most cheerful frame of mind. His good humour was even greater when he saw Kitty completely recovered. The news of Kitty's friendship with Madame Stahl and Varenka, and the reports the princess gave him of some kind of change she had noticed in Kitty, troubled the prince and aroused his habitual feeling of jealousy of everything that drew his daughter away from him, and a dread that his daughter might have got out of the reach of his influence into regions inaccessible to him. But these unpleasant matters were all drowned in the sea of kindliness and good humour which was always within him, and more so than ever since the Carlsbad Spa. The day after his arrival, the prince, in his long overcoat with his Russian wrinkles and baggy cheeks propped up by a starched collar, went off with his daughter to the Wells in the greatest good humour. It was a lovely morning. The bright, cheerful houses with their little gardens, the sight of the red-faced, red-armed, beer-drinking German housemaids working away merrily, did the heart good. But the nearer they got to the Well, the oftener they met sick people, and their appearance seemed more pitiable than ever among the customary conditions of well-ordered German life. Kitty was no longer struck by this contrast. The bright sun, the brilliant green of the foliage, the strains of the music were, for her, the natural setting of all these familiar faces, with their changes for worse or for better, for which she watched. But to the prince, the brightness and gaiety of the June morning, and the sound of the orchestra playing a gay waltz, then in fashion, and above all, the appearance of the healthy attendants, seemed to be something inappropriate and monstrous, in conjunction with these slowly moving, dying figures gathered together from all parts of Europe. In spite of his feeling of pride and, as it were, of the return of youth with his favourite daughter on his arm, he felt awkward and almost ashamed of his vigorous step and his sturdy, stout limbs. He felt almost like a man naked in a crowd. "Present me to your new friends," he said to his daughter, squeezing her hand with his elbow. "I even like your horrid Soden for making you so well again. Only it's sad, very sad here. Who's that?" Kitty mentioned the names of all the people they met, some of whom she was acquainted with, and some not. At the entrance of the garden, they met the blind lady, Madame Berthe, with her guide, and the prince was delighted to see the old Frenchwoman's face light up when she heard Kitty's voice. She at once began talking to him with exaggerated French politeness, applauding him for having such a delightful daughter, extolling Kitty to the skies before her face, and calling her a treasure, a pearl, and a consoling angel. "Well, she's the second angel, then," said the prince, smiling. "She calls Mademoiselle Varenka Angel Number One."
"Oh,"
Mademoiselle Varenka, she's a real angel. Allez,
Madame Berthe assented. In the arcade, they met Varenka herself. She was walking rapidly toward them, carrying an elegant red bag.
Here's Papa, Kitty said to her. He's just come.
Varenka made, simply and naturally, as she did everything, a movement between a bow and a curtsy, and immediately began talking to the prince without shyness, naturally, as she talked to everyone.
Of course I know you. I know you very well, the prince said to her with a smile,
in which Kitty detected with joy that her father liked her friend.
Where are you off to in such haste?
Maman is here, she said, turning to Kitty. She's not slept all night, and the doctor advised her to go out. I'm taking her her work.
So that's angel number one, said the prince when Varenka had gone on.
Kitty saw that her father had meant to make fun of Varenka, but that he couldn't do it because he liked her.
Come, so we shall see all your friends, he went on, even Madame Stahl, if she sees fit to recognize me.
Why, did you know her, Papa? Kitty asked apprehensively, catching the gleam of irony that kindled in the prince's eyes at the mention of Madame Stahl.
I used to know her husband, and her too, a little, before she joined the Pietists.
What's a Pietist, Papa? Asked Kitty, dismayed to find that what she prized so highly in Madame Stahl had a name.
I don't quite know myself. I only know that she thanks God for everything, for every misfortune. And thanks God, too, that her husband died.
And that's rather funny, because they didn't get along together.
Who's that? What a piteous face, he asked,
noticing a sick man of medium height sitting on a bench wearing a brown overcoat and white trousers that fell in strange folds above his long, fleshless legs. This man lifted his straw hat, showing his thin, curly hair and high forehead, painfully reddened by the pressure of the hat.
That's Petrov, an artist, answered Kitty, blushing. And that's his wife, she added, indicating Anna Pavlovna, who, as though on purpose, at the very instant they approached, walked away after a child who had run off along a path.
Poor fellow, and what a nice face he has, said the prince. Why don't you go up to him? He wanted to speak to you.
Well, let us go then, said Kitty, turning round resolutely. How are you feeling today? She asked Petrov.
Petrov got up, leaning on his stick, and looked shyly at the prince.
This is my daughter, said the prince. Let me introduce myself.
The painter bowed and smiled, showing his strangely dazzling white teeth.
We expected you yesterday, princess,
he said to Kitty. He staggered as he said this, and then repeated the motion, trying to make it seem as if it had been intentional.
I meant to come, but Varenka said that Anna Pavlovna sent word you weren't going.
Not going, said Petrov, blushing,
and immediately beginning to cough, and his eyes sought his wife.
Anita! Anita!
He said loudly, and the swollen veins stood out like cords on his thin white neck. Anna Pavlovna came up.
So you sent word to the princess that we weren't going?
He whispered to her angrily, losing his voice.
Good morning, princess, said Anna Pavlovna, with an assumed smile utterly unlike her former manner. Very glad to make your acquaintance, she said to the prince. You've long been expected, prince.
Why did you send word to the princess that we weren't going?
The artist whispered hoarsely once more, still more angrily. Obviously exasperated that his voice failed him, so that he couldn't give his words the expression he would have liked.
Oh, goodness me! I thought we weren't going,
his wife answered crossly.
What? When?
He coughed and waved his hand. The prince took off his hat and moved away with his daughter. Ah, he sighed deeply.
Oh, poor things.
Yes, Papa, answered Kitty. And you must know they've three children, no servant, and scarcely any means.
He gets something from the academy, she went on briskly, trying to drown the distress that the peculiar change in Anna Pavlovna's manner toward her had aroused in her.
"Oh, here's Madame Stahl," said Kitty, indicating a wheelchair, where, propped on pillows, something in grey and blue was lying under a sunshade. This was Madame Stahl. Behind her stood the gloomy, healthy-looking German workman who pushed the carriage. Close by was standing a flaxen-headed Swedish count whom Kitty knew by name. Several invalids were lingering near the wheelchair, staring at the lady as though she was some curiosity. The prince went up to her, and Kitty detected that disconcerting gleam of irony in his eyes. He addressed Madame Stahl with extreme courtesy and affability in that excellent French that so few speak nowadays.
"I don't know if you remember me, but I must recall myself to you to thank you for your kindness to my daughter," he said, taking off his hat and not putting it on again.
"Prince Alexander Shcherbatsky," said Madame Stahl, lifting upon him her heavenly eyes, in which Kitty discerned a look of annoyance. "Delighted. I've taken a great liking to your daughter."
"You're still in poor health."
"Yes, I'm used to it," said Madame Stahl,
and she introduced the prince to the Swedish count.
"You've scarcely changed at all," the prince said to her. "It's 10 or 11 years since I have the honour of seeing you."
"Yes. God sends the cross and sends the strength to bear it. Often one wonders what the goal of this life is."
"The other side,"
she said angrily to Varenka, who had rearranged the comforter over her feet, not to her satisfaction.
"To do good, probably," said the prince with a twinkle in his eye.
"That is not for us to judge," said Madame Stahl, perceiving the shade of expression on the prince's face. "So you will send me that book, dear Count. I'm very grateful to you," she said to the young Swede.
"Ah!" cried the prince, catching sight of the Moscow colonel standing near, and with a bow to Madame Stahl, he walked away with his daughter and the Moscow colonel, who joined them. "That's our aristocracy, prince," the Moscow colonel said with ironical intent.
He cherished a grudge against Madame Stahl for not making his acquaintance.
"She's just the same," replied the prince. "Did you know her before her illness, prince? That is, before she took to her bed?" "Yes, she took to her bed before my eyes," said the prince. "They say it's 10 years since she stood on her feet." "She doesn't stand up because her legs are too short. She had a very bad figure."
"Papa, it's not possible," cried Kitty.
"That's what wicked tongues say, my darling. And your Varenka catches it too," he added. "Oh, these invalid ladies."
"Oh, no, Papa," Kitty objected warmly. "Varenka worships her. And then she does so much good. Ask anyone. Everyone knows her and Alina Stahl."
"Perhaps so," said the prince, pressing her hand with his elbow. "But it's better when one does good in such a manner that no one knows of it."
Kitty didn't answer, not because she had nothing to say, but because she didn't care to reveal her secret thoughts even to her father. But strange to say, although she'd made up her mind not to be influenced by her father's views, not to let him into her inmost sanctuary, she felt that the heavenly image of Madame Stahl, which she had carried for a whole month in her heart, had vanished, never to return, just as the fantastic figure made up of some clothes thrown down at random vanishes when one sees that it is only some garment lying there. All that was left was a woman with short legs, who lay down because she has a bad figure, and tormented patient Varenka for not arranging her comforter to her liking. And by no effort of the imagination could Kitty bring back the former Madame Stahl. Chapter 35. The prince communicated his high spirits to his own family and his friends, and even to the German landlord in whose rooms the Shcherbatskys were staying. On coming back with Kitty from the Wells, the prince, who had asked the colonel and Maria Yevgenyevna and Varenka all to come and have coffee with them, gave orders for a table and chairs to be taken into the garden under the chestnut tree, and lunch to be laid there. The landlord and the servants, too, grew brisker under the influence of his high spirits. They knew his generous nature, and half an hour later, the invalid doctor from Hamburg, who lived on the top floor, looked enviously out of the window at the merry party of healthy Russians assembled under the chestnut tree. In the trembling circles of shadow cast by the leaves, at a table covered with a white cloth and set with coffee-pot, bread and butter, cheese and cold game, sat the princess in a high cap with lilac ribbons, distributing cups of coffee and sandwiches. At the other end sat the prince, eating heartily and talking loudly and merrily. The prince had spread out near him his purchases, carved boxes, knick-knacks, paper knives of all sorts, of which he bought a heap at every spa, and bestowed them upon everyone, including Lieschen, the servant girl, and the landlord, with whom he jested in his comically bad German, assuring him that it wasn't the water that had cured Kitty, but his splendid food, especially his prune soup. The princess laughed at her husband for his Russian ways, but she was more lively and good-humoured than she had been all the while she had been at the spa. The colonel smiled, as he always did at the prince's jokes, but as far as regards Europe, of which he believed himself to be making a careful study, he took the princess's side. The simple-hearted Maria Yevgenyevna simply roared with laughter at everything absurd the prince said, and his jokes made Varenka helpless with feeble but infectious laughter, which was something Kitty had never seen before. Kitty was glad of all this, but she couldn't be light-hearted. She couldn't solve the problem her father had unconsciously created for her by his good-humoured view of her friends and of the life that had so attracted her. To this doubt there was joined the change in her relations with the Petrovs, which had been so conspicuously and unpleasantly marked that morning. Everyone was happy, but Kitty couldn't feel cheerful, and this increased her distress. She knew a feeling such as she had known in childhood, when she had been locked in her room as a punishment, and had heard her sister's merry laughter outside.
"Well, but why did you buy this mass of things for?" said the princess, smiling and handing her husband a cup of coffee.
"One goes for a walk, one looks in a shop, and they ask you to buy."
"Eminence, Excellency, Serene Highness."
"As soon as they get to Serene Highness, I can't hold out.
I lose $10.
"But it's simply from boredom," said the princess.
"Of course it is. Such boredom, my dear, that one doesn't know what to do with oneself."
"How can you be bored, prince? There's so much that's interesting now in Germany," said Maria Yevgenyevna.
"But I know everything that's interesting. The prune soup I know, and the pea sausages I know. I know everything."
"No. You may say what you like, prince. Their institutions are of interest," said the colonel.
"But what is there interesting about it?
They're all as pleased as a shiny kopeck. They've conquered everybody. And why am I to be pleased at that? I haven't conquered anyone. And I'm obliged to take off my own boots. Yes, and put them away too. In the morning, get up and dress at once, and go to the dining room to drink bad tea. How different it is at home. You get up in no haste, you get cross, grumble a little, and recover again. You have time to think things over. No need to hurry about anything." "But time's money, you forget that," said the colonel. "Time indeed, that depends. Why, there's time one would give a month of for 50 kopecks, and time you wouldn't give half an hour of for any amount. Isn't that so, Katinka? What is it? Why are you so depressed?"
"I'm not depressed."
"Where are you off to? Stay a little longer," he said to Varenka.
"I must be going home," said Varenka, getting up, and again she went off into a giggle. When she'd recovered, she said good-bye and went into the house to get her hat. Kitty followed her. Even Varenka struck her as different. She wasn't worse, only different from what she had thought her before.
"Oh, dear. It's a long time since I've laughed so much," said Varenka, gathering up her parasol and her bag. "How nice he is, your father."
Kitty didn't speak.
"When shall I see you again?" asked Varenka.
"Mama meant to go and see the Petrovs.
"Won't you be there?" said Kitty, testing Varenka.
"Yes,"
answered Varenka.
"They're getting ready to go away, so I've promised to help them pack."
"Well, I'll come too, then."
"No, why should you?"
"Why not?
Why not?
Why not?" said Kitty, opening her eyes wide, and clutching at Varenka's parasol so as not to let her go.
"No, wait a minute. Why not?"
"Oh, nothing.
Your father has come. And besides, they will feel awkward at your helping."
"No, tell me. Why don't you want me to be at the Petrovs?
You don't want me to.
Why not?"
"I didn't say that," said Varenka quietly.
"No, please tell me."
"Tell you everything?" asked Varenka.
"Everything, everything," Kitty assented.
"Well, there's really nothing of any consequence. Only that Mikhail Alexeyevich, that was the artist's name, had meant to leave earlier, and now he doesn't want to go away," said Varenka, smiling.
"Well,
well?" Kitty urged impatiently, looking darkly at Varenka.
"Well, and for some reason Anna Pavlovna told him that he didn't want to because you're here. Of course, that was nonsense. But there was a dispute over it. Over you. You know how irritable these sick people are."
Kitty, scowling more than ever, kept silent.
And Varenka went on speaking alone, trying to soften or soothe her, and seeing a storm coming, she didn't know whether of tears or of words.
"So you'd better not go. You understand. You won't be offended."
"And it serves me right. It serves me right," Kitty cried quickly, snatching the parasol out of Varenka's hand and looking past her friend's face. Varenka felt inclined to smile, looking at her childish fury, but she was afraid of hurting her.
"How does it serve you right? I don't understand," she said.
"It serves me right because it was all false, because it was all pretense and not from the heart. What business had I to interfere with outsiders? And so it's happened that I'm the cause of a quarrel and that I've done what nobody asked me to do, because it was all a fake, a fake, a fake."
"False? Why did you have to pretend?" said Varenka gently.
"Oh, it's so idiotic, so hateful. There was no need whatever for me. Nothing but falseness," she said, opening and shutting the parasol.
"But why?"
"To seem better to people, to myself, to God. To deceive everyone. No, now I won't descend to that. I'll be bad, but anyway, not a liar, a cheat."
"But who is a cheat?" said Varenka reproachfully. "You speak as if..."
But Kitty was in one of her gusts of fury, and she wouldn't let her finish.
"I don't talk about you, not about you at all. You're perfection."
"Yes, yes, I know you're all perfection. But what am I to do if I'm bad?
This would never have been if I weren't bad.
So let me be what I am. I won't be a fake. What have I to do with Anna Pavlovna? Let them go their way and me go mine. I can't be different. And yet it's not that. It's not that."
"What is not that?" asked Varenka in bewilderment.
"Everything. I can't act except from the heart, and you act from principle. I liked you because I liked you, but you probably only wanted to save me, to improve me."
"You're unfair," said Varenka.
"But I'm not speaking of other people, I'm speaking of myself."
"Kitty," they heard her mother's voice, "come here. Show Papa your coral necklace."
Kitty, with a haughty air, without making peace with her friend, took the coral necklace from a little box on the table and went to her mother.
"What's the matter? Why are you so flushed?" her mother and father said to her with one voice.
"Nothing," she answered. "I'll be right back." And she ran back. "She's still here," she thought. "What am I to say to her? Oh dear, what have I done? What have I said? Why was I rude to her? What am I to do? What am I to say to her?" thought Kitty, and she stopped in the doorway.
Varenka, in her hat and with a parasol in her hands, was sitting at the table examining the spring of her parasol, which Kitty had broken. She lifted her head.
"Varenka, do forgive me, do forgive me," whispered Kitty, going up to her. "I don't remember what I said. I
really didn't mean to hurt you," said Varenka, smiling. Peace was made, but with her father's coming, the whole world in which she had been living was transformed for Kitty. She didn't give up everything she had learned, but she became aware that she had deceived herself in supposing she could be what she wanted to be. Her eyes were, it seemed, opened. She felt all the difficulty of maintaining herself without hypocrisy and self-conceit on the pinnacle she had wished to mount. Moreover, she became aware of all the dreariness of the world of sorrow, of sick and dying people in which she had been living. The efforts she had made to like it seemed to her intolerable. And she felt a longing to get back quickly into the fresh air, to Russia, to Yagushova, where, as she knew from letters, her sister Dolly had already gone with her children. But her affection for Varenka didn't wane. As she said goodbye, Kitty begged her to come and see them in Russia.
"I'll come when you get married," said Varenka.
"I shall never marry."
"Well, then,
I shall never come."
"Well, then, I shall be married simply for that."
"Mind you remember your promise," said Kitty. The doctor's prediction was fulfilled. Kitty returned home to Russia, cured. She was not as gay and thoughtless as before, but she was serene. Her Moscow troubles had become a memory.